Well, my notes tell me that we have students from Port Washington High School present. If they're here, would they please stand? Oh, wow, you have a big group. Well, thank you very much for visiting with us. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that the Supreme Court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. As part of that program, one of the justices, after this oral argument, will come down and speak with you, not about the substance of this case, but a little bit about how the Supreme Court operates. Today it's going to be Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits here, and here she arrives.
Amen. Let's try right. That. Can we try that one more time?
No, I think once is enough. You know she's an amateur thespian, can you tell? A little bit.
Thank you.
So, in any case, she will come down and talk with you, and also the students that were here at 9:30 or 9:45 may come back. I'm not sure what their schedules were like. Now, I've introduced Justice Ann Walsh Bradley as she came dancing in for all of us. On my right is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is Justice Michael Gableman. On the far left is Justice Daniel Kelly. You will notice we have two empty chairs on the right. Usually on the far, far right of the bench sits Justice Rebecca Bradley, and next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. They are not participating in this case, so they're not just late for oral arguments. They will not be participating, so the five of us will be the decision makers. With that introduction, I will call the second case, Smith versus Anderson. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is John McElrath, and I represent the appellant R&B Construction, Inc. The respondent, West Bend Mutual Insurance Company, is R&B's insurance company. When R&B was sued in this case, it tendered the defense to West Bend. West Bend intervened in the action to seek and obtain judgment that it had no duty to defend R&B. R&B appeals that judgment. In the case leading to this appeal, R&B was named as a third-party defendant. The plaintiff in the case, Maya Smith, sued the defendant and third-party plaintiff, Jeff Anderson, alleging that the house that he had sold her had defects. Jeff Anderson in turn sued R&B, a contractor, and Fourth Dimension Design, Inc., an engineering firm, asserting that he had a right to contribution or indemnification for the alleged damages resulting from those defects. Both R&B and Fourth Dimension had worked on the house prior to Anderson's sale to Smith. The circuit court, Judge Pedro Colon, ruled that the third-party complaint against R&B sufficiently stated a claim that something that R&B did in the course of reinforcing the basement walls of Smith's home caused the damage alleged in Smith's complaint, namely the leaking and seepage, which led to a clogging of the drain tile in the foundation of the home. R&B's policy should cover such a claim. Unfortunately, the trial court's ruling came approximately 2 months after the court had dismissed West Bend Mutual.
That case that's still pending.
Yes, yes. Justice.
Okay. And the only one that's before, only case before this court is the one in which the trial court declared that the insurance company is not liable to defend.
That's correct.
The trial court issued, there was no written decision here by the trial court.
There's no written decision on either motion hearing.
And what the trial court did, the explanation is in the transcript, right?
Yes, sir.
And the transcript is very short on this.
It's very short.
And the trial court declared no duty to defend and no liability, no coverage for liability.
Correct.
Both.
The whole discussion before the trial court was really duty to defend, because the court's analysis dealt with the really the what the complaint alleged.
As you stated in your beginning, there was a reservation of rights and there was an appointment of counsel to represent R&V, isn't it? Wasn't it?
There was a reservation of rights, and West Penn appointed counsel, and then they came in and intervened.
Right. Now, so they doubled back, though. Their first position was, okay, we'll defend you, but we're not agreeing that we're ultimately liable for any damages.
That would be correct. But right. They answered, and then days later filed a motion to intervene.
They switched. Can they do that?
They can do that.
Why?
The court has said that an insurance company can intervene in the action try to get out.
But isn't the intervention usually without a reservation of rights and an appointment of counsel and an agreement to represent?
I'm not sure on that.
But you're not relying on that. You're not relying on the Olson case that says if you have a reservation of right, then the four corners rule is gone.
No, I think...
You're not relying on that.
If I understand the Olson case, it was not a case that was done on duty to defend. It was really to the second part of it, whether
liability.
Or not, whether it is coverage.
Yeah, right. Okay. I understand that. But that's because they agreed to defend the reservation of rights on coverage.
Right. I think this case is a somewhat unique, Justice Abrahamson, because my client absolutely denies anything that he did cause the problem with this basement. But this court has said that a claim can be fraudulent, it can be spurious, it can be whatever, but if it states a claim that might have been covered under an insurance policy, there is a duty to defend. So I see this case more as strictly a duty to defend case than as a case that addresses whether there should be ultimately coverage, because my client himself doesn't agree with the allegations of the complaint. There's so many cases
which
this court
complaint?
Has considered.
Let's talk about which complaint are we talking about?
I think you have to construe both together, because a third-party complaint incorporates the complaint against incorporates the complaint made against Smith. Smith has made against Anderson. So, and in fact, it was attached when it was asserted to my client.
All right. So where in either complaint or them reading together do you think that the insurance company has a duty to defend?
I think if the complaint states a claim, and here I'm borrowing from
which complaint?
Okay, if we start with the third-party complaint.
Right, okay.
The complaint says that at paragraph 5 that the Anderson provided my client with a design detail to perform repairs to the foundation. He directed my client in paragraph 6 to follow the recommendations of Fourth Dimension report and drawings to do this, and this was mindful. This is on the basement walls of this home. It says that at paragraph 7 that the everything was done in accordance with specifications. In paragraph 8, it says that my client inspected the east wall of the basement, made some recommendations. At paragraph 9, says that the Anderson directed my client to install drain tiles along the base of the east wall, not the whole house, along the base of the east wall, and also to install a sump pump, some crack and sump pump in that area. I'm taking from the complaint. Some of these are not true, but I'm taking from what exists in the complaint. And then at paragraph 10, he says that my client properly installed the new drain tile system, the sump pump, and made certain that it was all in good working order, and it was working. That's what the allegation is. Starting at paragraph 12 and paragraph 15, Mr. Anderson, who is sued at this point, is alleging a claim for contribution in addition to other claims. It says, in addition, this is paragraph 12, this defendant requests that the third-party defendants contribute their respective share of liability, and a claim for contribution is hereby asserted against the third-party defendants. Now, to get to that, I'll finish with this, but to get to that, we have to go to the attached complaint. At paragraph 15, again, it states, in the event that the defendant is found obligated to the plaintiff in any respect, then this defendant demands that this defendant be made whole for any amounts this defendant may be obligated to pay to the plaintiff from the third-party defendants, Fourth Dimension Design, and my client by way of indemnification and contribution.
Counsel, let's start with the complaint. It's for misrepresentation against Anderson, correct?
That's the Smith complaint.
The Smith complaint against Anderson. That's founded in misrepresentation.
I agree. I think it's a misrepresentation complaint. But that's not the way Judge Colon interpreted it.
Well, is there any other basis on which Smith could recover from Anderson other than misrepresentation?
As stated, I know what's stated as causes of action in the complaint. I don't know the answer to that, whether or not there's some theory out there that between, because my client's really not privy to all their dealings.
Exactly. So as we look at the state of the pleadings, it appears from the complaint that the only claim being made is in misrepresentation of torts, yes?
It may appear that way, but it is not interpreted that way by...
Let's not look at how its effect on R&B for the moment. Let's just look at between Smith and Anderson. Right?
Okay.
It's a misrepresentation complaint.
Granted.
Okay. So anything that Smith could recover from Anderson under that state of the pleadings would be based on misrepresentation. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Now we look at Anderson's complaint against R&B. And essentially, it's a pass-through.
So I don't agree, because a claim for contribution is not essentially a pass-through. When we get to
let me just stop you for just a second. The claim for contribution is that Anderson looks at R&B and says, "You might be liable to me because I'm liable to Smith," right?
In the most general sense, yes.
Okay. And when Anderson's pointing back at Smith, he's saying, because he says I misrepresented the condition of the house, right?
It may be so, but it's not necessary that a contribution claim doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that it has to be a contribution for misrepresentation. It can be. The way this court has described it before, there's a shared responsibility, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a participation in the same cause of action.
Well,
in other words, it doesn't have to be that my client made a co-misrepresentation to the plaintiff.
But contribution has to be based on joint tortfeasors, right? So your client has to be a tortfeasor to have a contribution claim lie against him, and the trial court seemed to say it might be negligence, which is what I assume you're here about, because the court had already dismissed the insurer, and if negligence had been broadly read from the pleadings before the trial court, insurance should have been provided at least up to a defense, correct?
Well, correct. I mean, this is what happened when we were in the second round before Judge Colon. The counsel representing Anderson said that there's enough breadth in the complaint to assert a negligence claim, and therefore, the contribution claim would lie.
All right. So, and I know that the circuit court was cryptic in this, but I want you to give me your best guess on what the basis of that negligence would be.
Would be a negligent misrepresentation claim. It would be my best guess would be that the Anderson was responsible not because he intentionally misrepresented the claim, but because he was unaware of it. He did some work on the house himself, actually.
I'm sorry, I wasn't sufficiently clear. So when R&B asked to be dismissed, circuit court said, no dismissal for you, there might be negligence there, right?
Correct.
What's your best guess on what that negligence was?
Well, what he actually is cryptic, but I mean, somewhat clear on that. He said that something that R&B did in straightening out the walls caused this drainage and seepage to the drain tile and onto the basement. And the drain tile, there's 120 feet of drain tile around the house, but there's something he did in straightening the walls. I mean, the walls that he was doing for the design, if you can picture the basement, he's adding structure to them, he's putting steel beams all the way around this basement. To prevent the walls from tilting in. The drain tile are underground or around the side. It doesn't appear that there's a connection between the two, but the judge, looking at the case, said he's not convinced that something they didn't do in straightening the walls, accidentally caused the leakage.
All right, so do you have any idea why Mr. Anderson has not amended the third-party complaint to make those specific allegations?
I wouldn't, truthfully, if I were in his shoes, I'm familiar with the theory that counsel should always be amending pleadings to do this. A lot of times, if you come away from a summary judgment and you kind of get what you want, you don't touch the pleadings. I mean, it's just like you don't want to do something to disturb a good result or react to it. I'm only guessing here, but if it is a practical matter, I think that's what people do. A practicing attorney would do.
But if I understand your position is that the third-party complaint here, although it doesn't expressly state that R&B was negligent, that it's ambiguous enough, and there's enough in it to read the third-party complaint as saying R&B was negligent in its work, or the design was negligent, and then following it was negligent. Isn't that your position?
That's my position, Your Honor.
But the third-party complaint never explicitly or expressly states negligence of R&B. I mean, I read your brief very carefully, and I think you were very honest and forthright in saying it ain't there specifically, but it's ambiguous. The rule is you read any ambiguity against the insurance company, and that this complaint liberally construed, and you're supposed to construe complaints liberally in favor of the insured, would be your client, R&B, is enough here in a third-party complaint to say no. But is that a good enough summary of your position?
I think that's fair, Your Honor. And it would cure what I perceive as a great injustice in this case. I think obviously that's the way it was construed by the circuit court later. I mean, whether that issue is before the court or not, I mean, that's what happened.
That's what happened, but that second summary judgment or the second ruling of the Supreme of the Circuit Court that they won't give a summary judgment to your client is not before the court. You tried to appeal it, but it hasn't been appealed.
I tried a petition for review. I explained exactly why, and it got denied. So here I am.
And I'm reading your brief. You keep coming back to that issue in the failing of the circuit court to give you a summary judgment, and says, "Look, you got looks like inconsistent rulings." Isn't that your basic position?
It is an inconsistent ruling, Your Honor. And I don't think the way I look at it. I mean, I don't think the court can just. I mean, it's hard to just ignore the big elephant, in the record before it. It's not critical to this court to decide that the Four Corners rule was inappropriately applied, because you can get there by fairly construing the pleadings to resolve ambiguity in favor of the insurer.
And you're not attacking or challenging the two decisions we held. Down last term that said you got to follow the four corners.
No, yeah, I had.
Not attacking that.
No, when in fact, I think that those decisions in the reaffirmance that you have to broadly, construe the complaint. I mean, it says that. It continued the language that. That not only it says that the insurer may have
counsel,
a clear duty to defend
counsel,
the claim that's utterly specious.
What opinion are you reading?
I'm sorry. This would be from the Water Wells case, and that would be at. Paragraph 25.
And it says what?
Yeah. When I put in my brief, I suggested that there might be other avenues for the court to consider. One of them was, to allow for the introduction of evidence, because here there's a lot of inconsistency between the pleadings and the reality. But I understand the court's position for those opinions. I'm not really, pushing that. I mean, I think that the other thing that's helpful about the court's recent opinions is there's this issue that I say, well, how on res judicata effect of a judgment declaring no duty to defend. And when I look at that, I think the court's first in the Waterwell case said that if there's an amendment to the pleading, you can start over. And I'm sure there's plenty of events that would trigger that. But it makes me think, how final is a judgment if a party can amend a pleading? And then res judicata, which usually is a resolution of all issues and issues that could have been raised between the parties that are done. I mean, is there really a res judicata effect to a declaration of no duty to defend?
Well, the declaration of no duty to defend is dependent upon the state of the pleadings at that point, correct?
Correct.
All right. So if the pleadings change, there wouldn't be a res judicata effect because the circumstances that be correct?
I think that, but there I've gotten the amicus brief that was filed with the court says otherwise. They're saying that the effect of the no duty to defend is res judicata, and you can pause what they say.
And opposing counsel appears to agree that this would be a potential way to resolve this, which is if the pleadings change, you can retender the defense. Is that sufficient for your purposes?
It doesn't work here. It really doesn't. I mean, because, I don't, I don't, you know, I understand that it, at least it's some mechanisms. I'm not going to go against any mechanism that's helpful to an insured, but it is so impractical here. I mean, do I get to, after the judge blown rules, do I get to retender when there's been no intervening amendment of the pleadings? There's so many things that can happen during a case that are analogous or even more powerful than amendment of pleadings that would re-trigger a duty to defend. I mean, my own personal perspective is this, is that when the court says there's no duty to defend, at least for that interim period, the insurance company has is in good faith discharged its obligation. But at any point in time in the case when that's when something happens that can trigger a duty to defend, you know, and there's another tender, there was never any finality to the first one. It just
all right. So if we were to hold that that's simply an interim ruling and it's not final, do we have the authority to do that? Can we declare that an order that resolves all issues between two parties is not final?
I don't think it resolves all issues between two parties, because I really don't. I mean, I think that if you have insurance, if you have an ongoing contract that has, how can it if the court permits the duty to recur if there's an amendment of the pleadings, how can it be a resolution of all issues between the parties?
Well, because it would be a resolution of all the issues on that state of the record.
Yeah, but res judicata, at least as it was, interpreted, I can remember the, it was Judge Fine's decision in the RV construction. It was Wisconsin, I think it was Wisconsin Public Service Commission versus RV construction. And, I mean, that has an interesting discussion, res judicata, but the concept is not only issues raised, but issues that might have been raised. So aren't we just inviting this whole controversy of how much of an amendment to the pleading is enough, or is enough to recreate the duty to defend? I kind of think that tack gets into more trouble, at least in the facts before me, because I have to resurrect it based on what Judge Colon had to say rather than the pleadings.
Well, wouldn't that require us to be answering more than we really need to? When you tender the defense in the first instance, you don't need court leave to do that. You exercise your professional judgment and you say, I think there might be coverage for this, and you tender it to the insurance company, right? Yes?
Okay,
all right, so now the insurance company comes in, asks for a declaration, no coverage, and no duty to defend. They get it. Now the pleadings change. Doesn't that simply put the onus back on you to exercise your professional judgment on whether you should tender that defense again to the insurance company?
Well, it really does shift the issue, because if you tender to the insurance company, you're kind of like on an even plane. The insurance company, it's kind of their burden to show that that they don't have a duty to defend you. If you retender and you have a prior judgment against you and it has some res judicata effect, I mean, what the amicus suggests is you follow 806.07, where the burden is on you to show that there's some manifest injustice that lets you assert your rights under the policy. The whole appeal standard changes. Now you're into whether the court has great discretion in deciding whether you can amend, and then the appellate standard is abuse of discretion. Versus,
and my apologies to my colleagues. I appear to have stepped on the red light again.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. It's my honor to be here today. My name is Jeff Level. I have the honor of representing West Bend Mutual Insurance Company in this appeal, and the honor of being with you today. I'd like to begin by going to the heart of most of the questions and discussion just heard, the materiality or not of the subsequent summary judgment decision. And I'm here to firmly tell you that that later summary judgment decision, that denial of summary judgment from Judge Colon, is immaterial to your decision today.
Why would it be immaterial if it suggests that there is potentially negligence on the part of R&B that arguably could be covered under an insurance contract?
Because at the Court of Appeals and here, we're on a document review, de novo, comparing a complaint to the policy. Multiple cases from this court and the Court of Appeals have made perfectly clear that you can affirm for reasons not even expressed on the record underneath, or you can affirm for reasons different from those offered underneath. Your review is de novo. You owe no deference to a circuit court's decision on a decision on appeal, and so I submit to you for the same reason, you would owe no deference to a decision that comes out after the appeal has commenced that might cause you to second guess.
But that decision is not before us. So,
correct.
So R&B is on the horns of a dilemma here. You've been excused, and the trial court refused to excuse R&B. And R&B, as it appears, it may be headed towards having to defend itself on the merits of whether it engaged in negligence that caused property damage. So why shouldn't the insurance company be there providing a defense?
Well, for several reasons. First, underlying the earlier argument is the assumption that Judge Colon said there was a potential negligence count lurking in that third-party complaint. There isn't. The third-party complaint very plainly says, first, that it seeks indemnification for any contingent liability that may be proved against them. It, in fact, even alleges, as was discussed, that R&B's work was done properly. But in the classic indemnification or contribution posture, it says, if I'm liable to the plaintiff, then you should indemnify me. And then in the Judge Colon's discussion, albeit brief, of what might be in that third-party complaint, he references faulty workmanship, possibly, and there's also discussion of a warranty. And I think, while not perfectly expressed, what's going on here is a misrepresentation claim that alleges pecuniary damages, not within the four corners of something that would invoke a duty to defend. And then the third-party complaint seeks warranty performance in the form of indemnity for any problem that the defendant may have to pay to plaintiff.
What happens if the proper interpretation of Judge Colon's denial of R&B summary judgment is that he thinks that there's something in the pleadings that might establish negligence in the performance of the work that caused property damage? That would be covered, wouldn't it?
Well, with a small disagreement, respectfully, yes. And here's the small disagreement. Policies don't cover negligence. And this court said so a couple of years ago, the last time I was before you, in Schinner versus Gundrum. Clearly, policies are concerned with occurrences that cause property damage. They're not pertinent to negligence. You'll search in vain in the policy for the word negligence. It's not there. They don't cover negligence. If Judge Colon had said there's an occurrence potentially in the third-party complaint and it caused property damage, and that's defined to be physically injured tangible property, generally, that would be a different matter. He never said that. He said there was a question potentially of responsibility for the conditions of the property, the conditions of the property that had been misrepresented to the buyer. So what the petitioner is seeking here is for this court to supply missing allegations in a third-party complaint or a complaint that aren't there. While it was just said it's not a challenge to the four corners rule, it plainly is. The petitioner wants you to assume allegations in the third-party complaint that don't exist. And one way to think about this is the Court of Appeals, the case is quoted Midway Motor Lodge in our brief, has said insurers are not mind readers. When they get a complaint, they're supposed to look at it, or for that matter, a third-party complaint, and look within the four corners for allegations of physical injured tangible property caused by an occurrence. They're not supposed to mind read it. nor is the circuit court. The circuit court's mind reading on it is no better. And if this court were to adopt a rule that allowed that mind reading to go on in the circuit court's mind, whether that's done through deferral of a final judgment ruling or supplying missing allegations, you will have gutted the Four Corners rule.
Counselor, I want to draw your attention to the third-party complaint, paragraphs 7 and 8. And 7 says, upon information and belief, the third-party defendant, R&V Construction, performed the reinforcement of basement walls in accord with the design drawing prepared by the defendant, Fourth Dimension. Then paragraph 8 talks about there being seepage problems along the wall. Now, it goes on to say other things that R&V did, but it does say that that's what they did in regard to their work on this property. And then if you go back and you look at the complaint, which is attached to the third-party complaint, and you look at the remedies that they're asking for, among many other things, the monies paid by plaintiff in purchasing and improving the property, moving costs, and other expenses related to purchasing the property. Now, why isn't that big enough to cover the property damage that this plaintiff sustained?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the paragraphs you quoted from the third-party complaints say that R&B was brought to this project to address leakage problems, not that it caused them.
Well, it was brought to address them, but that still can be read, if they're getting sued for what they did or didn't do here, and the problem with the property, as I understand, is leakage. I think that the statements are certainly broad enough to say they didn't do anything to help with this problem, and that's why they were brought to the property.
The allegations of the complaint are classic misrepresentation.
Oh, I get you on that. Just looking at the remedy that they're asking for, and the remedy seems to me to be quite broad. And the complaint is in some ways a little bit inconsistent in that they ask for some remedies that are really inconsistent with one another. But be that as it may, I don't see why what they're asking for, that it costs them to improve the property, isn't sufficient to cover trying to fix what they're saying that R&B didn't do well.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in the wherefore clause, in the just before the rescission allegations,
mm-hmm.
In the complaint,
right.
It describes the damage they want, which is the difference in value between the property as represented and its actual value,
right.
and the cost of putting the property in the condition it was represented to be in.
Right.
That's at page 5 of the complaint.
That's right.
That's a reiteration of J.I. Civil 2405, which is the misrepresentation measure of damages that was addressed expressly in the Qualman decision.
It may be the way that you often express misrepresentation damages. I'm not saying that that's not the case, but I do think you can't read the misrepresentation that's set out in the initial complaint and say there can't be a negligence claim made in the third-party complaint. I think you read them all together to try to determine what happened and why are these folks in court in relationship to this house. But I agree with what you're saying. The complaint is for misrepresentation. But I do think when you collapse them together, you can get a broader reading out of the amended complaint than perhaps the circuit court and the court of appeals obtained.
But our view, again, respectfully, Your Honor, is that if you did that, you would be ignoring the essential nature of an indemnification third-party action, because paragraph 12 really says it all in the third-party complaint.
You have to be joint tortfeasors to get contribution. Usually for indemnification, it's contractual, not joint tortfeasors, correct?
Equitable indemnification is predicated chiefly on the idea that the defendant, this case, has had to answer for the sins of another.
Mm-hmm.
And so in an equitable indemnification claim, which I submit that's what this is, it's alleged in paragraph 12,
mm-hmm.
the third-party plaintiff or the defendant is saying, if I have to answer for this misrepresentation, you, R&B, should pay for it. And why would that be? It would be because R&B had warranted that work to Anderson. and it's not because there was an occurrence causing property damage. This third-party complaint seeks to pass through directly the liability
involved. You want the complaint to totally drive the third-party complaint. And all I'm saying to you is, what case do you rely on to say you don't read them both together? You're saying the complaint is misrepresentation. I'm not arguing with you about that. I'm saying that the damages they request in the complaint are quite broad, and if the third-party complaint can be held to allege negligence in the paragraphs I pointed out, I think you have to read them both together. I don't think you can limit the third-party complaint to misrepresentation.
Perhaps I'm being unclear. I completely agree with you. You have to read it's an amended complaint together with the third-party complaint.
Well, I was reading the complaint because the amended complaint came out after the decision for you. But go ahead.
The amended complaint and the third-party complaint, in my view, and certainly it's argued in our brief, they have to be read together.
Mm-hmm.
And reading them, both of them, you will not find an occurrence, which is an accident or continued or repeated exposure. You won't find an allegation that R&B caused any property damage, and you won't find an allegation that there is property damage. You will find an allegation that there was a plugged drain line with red ochre, something that is cleaned out, maintained, not because the pipe is physically injured, but because it has things plugging it. Similarly, the leaking that occurred isn't by itself physically injured tangible property. The Kaltstaller case we've cited, for example, explains that leaking windows that cause damage to the interior, that's an occurrence causing property damage. The mere presence of a leak doesn't describe physically injured tangible property.
You don't think that a leaky basement damages the basement? I don't think most people would find that true. If they bought a house, they sure don't want one with a leaky basement.
Well, certainly they don't want it, but did it cause physically injured tangible property?
Well,
no.
You can't use the basement for keeping things dry or stored. So the basement is damaged. It can't be used for all the things many of us use our basements for.
That's not alleged here either. Again, what you're doing is supplying allegations to a pleading that aren't there. And
one of the things that was alleged was that the drain tiles were clogged and therefore could not perform the function. Isn't that loss of use?
It's not characterized as such. And I would submit to you what it describes as defective maintenance. I mean, red ochre is something one rinses out of a pipe. It doesn't require the pipe to be replaced. Nor is there an allegation here that they were deprived of use of the basement or the drainage system, simply that it clogged.
It might be easy to remedy it if it's just a maintenance issue, but nonetheless, if the faulty workmanship caused the loss of use of those drain tiles because they were clogged, isn't that loss of use within the terms of the insurance policy?
It may also be within the terms of the exclusion, something that was argued at the Court of Appeals and never decided. And that was a ruling that Judge Colon made here as well. So if it's the insured's work and the work is defective and it causes damage to its own work that has to be repaired or replaced, that's an excluded damage under the liability policy.
Right. But if it causes loss of use or damage to other property, that would be covered.
Quite possibly. But that's not alleged in the pleadings we have here in front of us. Nowhere is that allegation made. And to supply it would supply missing allegations and gut the four corners rule and deprive all litigants of the predictability that comes from looking at the pleading allegations and comparing them to the terms of the insurance policy. That this petitioner's effort is the camel's nose into the tent on the end of the four corners rule. And I think that's why the amicus argues about this case. Submitted a brief.
You would agree, counsel, that if the complaint or third-party complaint were alleged and the new allegations arguably applied something for which there would be coverage, that R&B could retender that?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking that, Your Honor. I wanted to address what I heard in the argument just a few moments ago. It's a very simple thing to retender an amended pleading to an insurance company. I've been doing this kind of work for over two decades, and it happens. Not frequently, but it happens. And when it happens, the insurance company is obliged to revisit that whole decision because they have new allegations. And why? Because of the Four Corners Rule. That Four Corners Rule drives them to look at that amended pleading. And if you start gutting that Four Corners Rule, you'll take away even that certainty. That insurer has to redo it. And it's simple, and it could be done if the allegations change.
Great. Let's address what I'm sure R&B is concerned with here. Let's say that somehow or other, this third-party complaint is construed to allow a negligence claim to go forward against R&B. He gets the judgment. Judgment's entered. And let's say for the purposes of our conversation that it is the judgment is entered for an occurrence that caused property damage. Can R&B now come back to West Bend and say, all right, here's my judgment, pay that, and here's what I paid to defend myself, pay that too?
Generally speaking, not unless they have notified the insurer, done the retender step, because if they have not provided that notice, then they have let the case go to verdict and deprived the insurer of this right to defend a case that alleged coverage.
Right. Let's assume the state of the pleadings stay the same. Nothing changes about the pleadings. Defense has been tendered. You've moved to bifurcate. You sought a declaration of no duty to defend. You received it. The case proceeds along with no change to the pleadings at all. And yet, at the end of it, R&B finds itself holding a judgment against it for an occurrence that caused property damage. Can he come to you and have you pay, indemnify him for that damage and for the cost of defense?
If that occur, well, I submit to you that couldn't occur, and here's why. You've asked me to assume the pleadings do not change. The present state of the pleadings is a complaint that's classically not covered under Everson and Stewart, and the third-party complaint simply looks to pass on that liability. Doesn't look to pass on any liability for an occurrence causing property damage. And so the judgment would not be a covered matter.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that a circuit court is capable of erring.
Of what?
Erring.
Making a mistake.
And that in this case, it does, and so does the Court of Appeals, and we decide not to review the decision, and so R&B has a judgment against it that there was an occurrence that caused property damage, and he has to pay that. Can he come to you now and say, look, I tried everything I could to get you to cover this, I tried everything I could to get the courts to review it, and yet here I am, a judgment that says occurrence causing property damage. Please pay.
Well, again, the judgment would have to emanate from the pleadings. So if the pleadings, you've asked me to again assume the pleadings don't change, and the Four Corners Rules guides us to the pleadings. And if the pleadings are as they presently are, that judgment could not be for occurrence caused property damage, because we know under Everson and Stewart this is not an occurrence, and we know for that matter under Qualman that the measure of damage here, which is alleged in the complaint, is purely J.I. Civil 2405. It's misrepresentation damage. And the pass-through of that liability by a third-party complaint wouldn't transmute that into an occurrence-caused property damage.
Right. But so your position and your arguments is based on the assertion that there's no possibility, given the state of the pleadings, that R&B could be found liable for an occurrence that caused property damage.
That's correct. And if I might use your question where you referenced the circuit court potentially making error, it reminded me of something I wanted to present to you today, and as I was thinking about the immateriality of this subsequent summary judgment decision, I thought, how to make it most stark? What if instead of that ruling, Judge Colon had come onto the bench and said, that decision I made a couple months ago on duty to defend, it was wrong. I wish I could recant that. What would be the result? The appeal's pending. The Court of Appeals has de novo review. The court's obliged to compare the complaint to the policy. And the circuit court judge's change of heart should be immaterial, because the circuit court judge's decision one way or another on that issue at that point has just become, at most, an advisory opinion, because your review is de novo, and you review it without having to be bound by any kind of finding or ruling at the circuit court level.
Counsel, years ago is a case where I dissented. Under 80607,
And I think sub H might be the catch-all phrase. And I took the position, look, you know, there are certain narrow, circumscribed places for 80607, and you've got to, that's relief from judgment. You've got to follow in that, and you can't open up this can of worms called the residual or the catch-all sub H, if I'm right. But I was in the dissent. And one of the things you can open up and get a relief from judgment is for just and equitable relief. Why wouldn't this be an occasion for just and equitable relief, given the horns of the dilemma described by Justice Kelly?
Well, in that extended hypothetical where there's a judgment that pops up that's sort of outside the pleading for occurrence causing property damage, that may well be. And I think... The case I think you're referencing is MLB, which was an 80607 case about what kind of burden there was on the movement to establish any other reason for relief. And it doesn't, I don't think it's bound by the one-year time limit. It
was wide open.
Complete catch-all. Which, you know, is an invitation to the ultimate discretion.
I think you
right?
agreed with my dissent. look, who would open
Anything goes there, right?
Who would open it up? Suppose this court holds with you. Then you got the trial court has a summary judgment, and it's before the Court of Appeals. So who can open up this case once this court decides it?
Well, I think a couple of things could happen. One, the pleadings could change, and it could be retendered. And then the court has to review, or the company has to revisit its duty to defend decision. Another instance might
How
be...
How can you think that R&B can change, that Anderson can change its pleadings, that R&B can change its pleadings after this court enters a decision in this case?
Well, I certainly know the statutes authorize pleading amendment even post-verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that rarely, but it occurs. And so that could happen. I could also see, and I certainly hope you affirm, because I believe that's what the law compels, but I could see an affirmance that got remanded, at discovery progressed, and an 80607 motion happened from my learned opponent, Mr. Maclack. That could happen. I don't think the court, this court, rendering and entering a decision now precludes that from happening. Now, having said that, I can say I've not researched that to come here today, but just my instinct tells me that's true.
I bet you research it if it happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this court's decision is not final. It's just a stop in the road waiting till what happens next in this case.
No, I disagree with that firmly. And
final for the...
Yes, Justice Kelly put a little bit ago, it's final on the state of the record as it exists, and records change. So, and it's important, it has great ramifications for who's paying for the defense and how the case moves forward. This is an important case for us, just as it's important for him. And so I don't want to leave you with the impression that there's some diminished vitality or finality from a decision here. It is... very important, regardless of whether there's a pleading amendment and a retender.
Why doesn't the court say something like, okay, on the basis of this pleading, A wins or loses, or B wins or loses, but you can replead. Is that what you want this court to say?
No, I think all the parties know they can replead even post-verdict. I think trial lawyers know that. As long as they get the circuit court's permission.
Ah. So why would they get the circuit court's permission here?
Because this court has frequently said, and it shall be freely given, I think is the exact words I've read in numerous decisions. Pleading amendment is always viewed liberally.
So maybe we should just send it back to the trial court and tell them to review the pleadings and allow amendment. Let it start again. So you get consistency in these cases, if that's one of the reasons for this.
Well, I submit to you that consistency is attained by sticking with the four corners rule. This court just months ago emphasized the significance of it and how it's been a part of our law for decades. I don't think...
Absolutely, and I'm with it 100%. But you've got special circumstances here. And you're so willing to let everybody amend all their pleadings. So what's good is the four corner rule if you can just get out of it by just changing your pleadings?
Well, a couple of things. One, I firmly disagree respectfully, Your Honor, that we have special circumstances here. What we have is a circuit court judge who, months after we got final judgment, ruled a denial on summary judgment, and his opinion at that point is nothing more than an advisory opinion on an appeal of a summary judgment decision, because...
Sort of important, though.
Well, lots of decisions from this court have said no, that when a summary judgment ruling on a contract or a policy becomes appealed, your review is de novo. You're not bound to defer. In fact, you can base your ruling on something you pulled out of thin air. It doesn't have to be what the circuit court addressed at all.
But then the circuit court and you guys can change it all by amending the pleadings.
But that's...
That makes sense to me.
Well, that's the four corners rule. I mean, the four corners rule come with some price, right? There's clarity to it. It's a long, cherished tradition of our law for multiple decades. But the underpinning of it is the allegations. And if the allegations change, then it has to be reengaged. And I think that's to the benefit of insurers. Because if those allegations change, they get another kick at the coverage cat.
Costly, though. They have to hire their own lawyer and bring all of this. That's a great expense.
Well, you know, I could say it's a great expense to insurers to have to seek intervention, stay in bifurcation, and go through all this process, too, and it is.
Sure, but I understand that.
We do it out of concern for the consequences if we don't.
Yeah.
And that's, to go to an earlier question you had, that's why in cases like this, frequently, we belt and suspenders it. We hire defense counsel under a reservation of rights, and we immediately move to intervene, stay, and bifurcate because we feel like we're doing what you told us to do, which is to try and stop the merits of a case from proceeding so that we can get to the insurance coverage issue right away, but we don't want to let the insured hang out there unprotected.
Well, but you're not paying for the insured's lawyer now, are you?
Of course. If we hire defense, not for this one, because he's hired to represent the policyholder against me on coverage. But West Bend, in this case, as insurers do in many, hired a defense lawyer under reservation of rights, and that costs money.
He hasn't done anything here for the insurer, has he?
Not against me on coverage, no.
No,
but he's
of
made,
course not. So but you say you hired somebody to represent the insurer, but you're not. You hired somebody, but he's not doing anything.
Well, I believe he did the answer in this case, Your Honor. He did. He was involved defending this insured before Mr. Makalak ever came on the scene.
How many days?
I honestly don't know.
I think it was five or four.
Well, I wouldn't presume, and I won't
it's
guess.
It's in the record that you hired him in one day, and then 4 or 5 days later you intervened.
We moved to intervene. We you never get it the day you ask for it. We waited months to get a hearing.
But no thing was done in that interim.
An answer would have been filed.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Counsel? As I understand your response to me, as I tried to get you to collapse both the third-party complaint and the complaint together, your answer is focused totally on the remedy that was requested in the third-party complaint, right? Because all it requests is judgment of indemnification or contribution, which takes you back to the complaint.
No, I refer, Frank, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I was referring to paragraph 12 in the third-party complaint where it makes the allegation. That's the first time the third-party complaint ever says anything about why the third-party defendant might be liable.
Right, that's true, but what I was going to finish my narration with, and perhaps I didn't understand you correctly, if the remedy had been judgment for any damages alleged to have flowed from the work performed on the house, you'd be in a different place. With the same third-party complaint?
Well, I honestly think it would have to have alleged a little bit more than that. We need an occurrence, right?
Well, if you're talking about reading them broadly, and you got seepage into the basement, and And if you can say that what you want is damage to the property as a relief, that's your concern. You say there's no occurrence because you don't have property damage, right? You could allege what's in there is floppy enough that I think you could come up with negligence. But in the request for relief, you don't have anything that focuses on property damage in either the third-party complaint or the complaint. Yes, no?
I know the wherefore clause in the complaint seeks the misrepresentation damages. Are you asking me to look at the wherefore clause?
It's on page 5 of the third-party complaint.
Right.
And the three things they ask for, you know, don't mention property damage for resulting from the work of R&B.
The wherefore clause does not, correct?
Yeah, right. And if it did, would you be in the same position you are today?
I think we would have won at the Court of Appeals and won at the Circuit Court as well.
Okay.
And I say that because in Qualman, the case, a decision that was not necessarily dispositive but clearly drove the Court of Appeals in this matter,
mm-hmm.
The plaintiff alleged cracked basement walls and defective kitchen pipes. And yet the court plainly held that that's not property damage because the damages sought were for misrepresentation type damages under 2405. And similarly, if I might.
Right, but you don't have a third party complaint with other allegations in that case.
In Qualman. Right, it was looking at the pleadings. And I say we look at the pleadings in this case, I mean universally, the complaint and the third party complaint.
Right.
And
I agree
Qualman
you have to read them together. I just was trying to figure out if there were additions to the third party complaint. As we read them together, would you be in a different place? And your answer is no. So that's
correct.
Fine.
Thank you. How do you reconcile the concepts of res judicata and you can amend the pleadings anytime?
I see my red lights on, but I presume
yes,
I can answer
you
that.
You may answer, right.
I go back to Justice Kelly's comment before that res judicata applies to the record as it presently exists. And if the allegations change, it's an entirely different world. And that's a consequence of the Four Corners Rule. The Four Corners Rule is a good rule, but there are some aspects of it that result in that consequence.
Well, it doesn't have to be a Four Corners Rule. It could be in a straight auto accident case and it's held against the driver. And then afterwards you find out something about in reconstruction and the car defect and you want to change your pleadings. Can you open that up again?
Well, I go back to my observation about the statute that authorizes pleading amendment shall be freely given even post-verdict.
Does it say if justice so requires? Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I thought the statute, and I haven't looked at it right now.
I think it's 80109.
I thought that dealt with a liberal amendment to pleading up to a certain time and date. I mean, what you seem to be espousing is that, or at least suggesting is that, this can really be like the shifting sands of Iowa, and that insurance company, you know, there's a joke. And that is that after we have decided something, the case can live on because there can be amendment of pleadings. You're not advocating that. That makes no sense to me. Do you think it really makes, you're advocating to this court that?
Well, not that it happened in every case. All I'm pointing out is that the statute combined with the case law, sets a pretty low bar for a party to say, I need to amend my pleadings. And I've always thought if a pleading could be amended after verdict, what exactly did the verdict address? But that's what the statute says. And I'm not advocating for multiple pleading amendments. I'm just saying there are avenues for relief for those who feel they are on the horns of a dilemma. And I don't believe this is the horns of a dilemma. But if it really were, there are statutory measures that are available.
80209 says one, and a party may amend the pleadings once as a matter of course any time within 6 months. Otherwise, a party may amend the pleading only by leave of court or written consent of the adverse party, and leave shall be freely given at any stage of the action when justice so requires. Well, when it's finished and it's res judicata, I don't know that you still have an action. but that's another issue. So I'm not sure that what you say about pleading, about amending pleading on the 80209 covers, because once it's finished and it's up here and there's a decision, there is no more action. The action is finished. So I'm not sure you can do that.
Okay.
Thank Otherwise, you'll never have finality here.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So are you going to go back and amend the pleadings?
No, when the court was engaged in this dialogue, it's not my pleadings to amend.
I know that.
I was just picturing, you know, what would happen as a practical matter to go down and say that, talk to counsel for the third-party defendant and say, hey, would you like to amend your pleadings? They say, why would I do that? I says, well, are you conceding that your client's responsible and your insurance company is going to pay? No, I'm not. So what's in it for me? Well, if you amend your pleadings, I'll be able to get him a paid defense. Oh, that's gonna sell the whole deal to him right away. It's not. I mean,
no,
it's a practical matter.
These things
don't happen. These
that's no small deal, right? I mean, when Anderson sues R&B, it's because they want some money.
Right.
Right. And so there is a significant incentive to amend their pleadings to get in such a way that they can get coverage, not just so that you can have your defense paid for, but so they can get payment on indemnification.
In every other case, in fact, most of the duty to defend cases that have been before this court, I would agree. But here, my client adamantly maintains he did nothing wrong with the house. So, I mean, all it does is it fuels, it helps fuel a better defense.
Well, perhaps so. But Anderson, presumably, was opposing your motion for summary judgment because he thinks there's a basis for getting you in there, and apparently on some negligent basis, right?
Right.
Okay. So so a little side conference with counsel for Mr. Anderson to say, hey, look, if you really think I was negligent, why don't you make your pleading say so? And then the insurance company comes in, and if you win, there's an ability to pay.
It would make perfect sense to me, but the dynamics of the case, you may figure that, okay, what's in it for me? Are you going to concede liability if I do that? No. And then we're into the mode where this just throws more money on the side of the defense. So,
thank you.
Just to recap my thoughts, Your Honor, on the four corners rule, which I think is the primary broadening, leaving that rule broad where you can really look at ambiguities in favor of my insured. I mean, it does permit consideration that a complaint has alternate claims. I mean, the way that Mr. Level has been arguing, it's like you pick out one claim and that's it. And that's not the way, that's not a broad reading of the complaint. With the, there were some questions on the wherefore clause on damages. He stopped reading at the point where it says cost of placing the property in the condition it was represented to be in. The very next clause is the cost of all repairs. And earlier in the complaint, it says in paragraph 7, in order to repair or correct the condition of the property, the plaintiff will need to replace the drain tile and install new drain tile. These are not rescission damages. And at paragraph 13, plaintiff has incurred and will incur substantial monetary damages. These are not, broadly stated, are not rescission damages. So what you have here is a situation where the four corners rule is supposed to benefit the insured, not the insurance company, and it's been forever the premise that the court resolves ambiguities in favor of the insured. If there's multiple claims, one way of doing that is to look for the claim that may be the insurable claim, which actually happened here later in the case. On this whole business of I pose it as a thought for the court or some way to address the inequity of a case like this and declaring that a judgment such as this is non-res judicata, but as I think the court sees by its questioning, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to figure what happens later in the case because, you know, you have different standards for reopening a judgment than you do when you just tender to the insurance company a complaint for defense. It's very hard to go hat in hand to a court and ask to reopen the judgment when, we're questioning here why, if that was a claim, why wasn't it alleged the first time? And why wasn't it all made part of the deal when you had these extensive motions before the court?
Well, if the judgment relates solely to the state of the pleadings at the time of the judgment, then you don't really need to go hat in hand to the court to get a retender. You just retender, right?
I think if that's the rule that the court said, that this is aside from res judicata, that at any point in time the party can go and retender, then we're really saying the order doesn't have res judicata effect.
Oh, it does. It's res judicata as to the state of the pleadings at that time. But if the pleadings change, I mean, think of it this way. When we're making a call on whether there's a duty to defend, the thing that we're going to judicata, the race is the state of the pleadings, right? That's it. And that stays locked in time for all time. So when the court says no duty to defend, it's no duty to defend with respect to that state of the pleadings. If we have amended pleadings, now we've got a new race.
I think the court would have to change the law of res judicata, particularly Judge Fine's opinion, because the law of res judicata, at least as stated by the court, albeit in other contexts, is like matters raised and that could have been raised in connection with the litigation. So if you're saying that it has res judicata, I go back in and say it no longer does. Take this case before the court. Is this a matter that could have been raised earlier? Well, I did raise it earlier, but you changed your mind. I don't see much traction in getting the court's decision changed around there. The whole res judicata principle is more than is different from collateral estoppel in my interpretation anyway, where you issue estoppel. But the thing is really the controversy between the parties. I may be wrong on that, but that's
the Court of Appeals should never hear the case because it's not final. If you can re-amend this, if you can amend the complaint and re-tender, it's not a final decision between the parties, and the Court of Appeals shouldn't be hearing it.
No. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for interesting argument. You know, just when we think we know what's going on with the Four Corners Rule, you all come and bring us something like this, which is really a hard case, a very hard case. Very well argued, very well briefed. So we all thank you, and we will struggle with it as you have, I can see. We are adjourned until we begin our third case for the day at 1:30. Thank you. I think we'll be out soon.